The last page there, funding for community corrections grows by almost $50 million in this budget. Overall, about half of that is due to inflation increases and caseload growth. The other half is due to an increase in community corrections based on cost studies done by both the DOC as well in cooperation with community corrections directors and sheriff's office. I'm sure the agency will talk more about that, but that is a major cost increase or a major policy package in this budget. You have seen from presentations in front of this committee about long-term investments or long-term savings from investments in programs.
Chair Shields, yes. Before we take that next step down, Doug, would you mind, you talk about roughly half the increases attributed to caseload growth and inflation. How much of the half is caseload growth and how much of the half is inflationary?
Actually, I'd have to go dig through my work papers in the office to figure that out, but I'll get
that. But we can come up with that? Thank
you. Yes, I can.
And if you could get that to all of us,
yeah,
that would be great. Good question.
And the inflation is at the general inflation rate that we provide most state agencies for those kinds of things. Recent studies, like I said, you've seen them from the fellow from Washington, from this Criminal Justice Commission, where that show that there are long-term savings from various programs. But unfortunately, if you take a look at what's happened over the last 8 years or so, the Department of Corrections, those are often the first programs that get cut, at least those that are funded from general fund. The third point on that page, Junction City is sort of the next facility that's been designated for building. The final decision is yet unclear. There are a number of factors in that. But if the decision is to go ahead with that in terms of the budgetary decisions that are included in the governor's recommended budget, that decision will have to be in a relatively time frame. If the current trends and decision making are in place, the design work is dependent on site conditions. There are also some other factors that are happening. The Junction City site has been designated sort of as one of the potential sites for one of the state hospital facilities. And in each case, both White City and Junction City, there has at least been interest expressed by the county in terms of doing some co-location of jail facilities at those sites. So that's another factor in there. And finally, the last point, the capital improvements budget for corrections for as many square feet and facilities they have has only been between $1 and $2 million per biennium for the past probably three or four biennia, if not more. This budget tries to address that. It includes a little less than $25 million in COP proceeds, certificates of participation, to address what is probably $60 million plus in deferred maintenance at this time. And please keep in mind some of the facilities like Snake River in Ontario are reaching that age where there are starting to be some significant deferred maintenance issues like roofs and things starting to loom up in any facility that reaches that age. So deferred maintenance is an important part of this budget, too. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably best to turn it over to you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just...
Representative Parker, then.
Mr. Wilson, on the ballot measure 11, I mean, I know that, you know, increases the population, but I'm not sure that that's all. I mean, when we say there's measure 11 causes this, because I would expect that if there was not measure 11, a lot of these people would be repeating and would be back in anyway, would be in prison anyway.
Yeah, these numbers reflect the direct and indirect effect of the sentences that are ballot measure 11. You're right that if those folks had not, if there was no ballot measure 11, they would be spending some time. This is the impact of ballot measure 11 to that population on a per-day basis. And I think Ms. Porter can probably address that better because these numbers do come from the Office of Economic Analysis.
Thank you.
Senator Westland.
Doug, I understand this is a highly technical budgeting term I've never quite been able to get my arms around, but with regard to the Junction City facility decision, will be made in the near future? I mean, has to be made. What's that mean? What's the timeline? What's the outer
Mr. Chair, what I guess I'm saying is if the current trends and the current plan for DOCs under their plans, if you are going to go ahead with Junction City this session, that decision has to be made given their plans. If the legislature finds another solution, whether it's sentencing, whether it's some other kind of incarceration potentially type, then that decision probably can be delayed. It's just that in that time frame of building a prison and getting it online, when they say under their prison population management plan, that decision is going to have to be made this session.
Okay, this session. I mean, yeah. If you just follow up, I mean, their plans are based on current law and projections. And
right.
They've got that down pretty good. And right. So anyway, okay, this session, that answers.
There are alternatives, Mr. Chair, Senator Wesslin, of many types.
Indeed. So, colleagues, as we go through this budget, we've got, I think, what, 6 or 7 days planned. On Monday, we will have public testimony, and so feel free to let any of your constituents know.
Monday, March 5th,
which
is a week
yes,
from this coming
you.
Monday.
And, you know, it's really important that we understand all of the aspects of this very large budget. So, you know, if we need to take more time to cover it all, so with that being said, Mr. Williams, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name, for the record, is Max Williams, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Seated to my right is Linda Gilbert from the DAS Budget and Management Office. And we appreciate the committee first giving early attention to the Department of Corrections budget and making the kind of time available you are making available for us to review this with you. As has been commented by both you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Wilson, this is a large part of the public safety budget, and we welcome the opportunity to inform you as much as we can and engage you in a conversation. I'm going to start out by just doing a quick sort of budget overview. I know that I've had several opportunities thus far to present to the committee, and I'm going to try to not use time today to repeat some of what I've already had an opportunity to talk about and to try to not repeat much of what Mr. Wilson has said in an effort to turn some time over at about 4 o'clock to Ms. Porter to talk about the forecast. But if you turn to the overview section tab in your notebooks, and on page 2, that sort of gives an outline of our plans with respect to the presentation. There is one small change that's been made since these were printed. We understood from Mr. Wilson that those of you interested in actually touring the penitentiary and looking at some particular program areas and issues there, that Monday was not a convenient day for that to occur. So we have switched the tour day to Tuesday. So we'll have Mr. Zerniak, who is the Assistant Director of Operations, begin a conversation about the operations division on day 2. We'll take the tour of the facility on day 3 and then attempt to follow the schedule as basically outlined following that. At the Chair's request, I would point out that on day 5, when Mr. Koreski, who's our Assistant Director of General Services, presents, we'll also use that time to brief the committee on the issues involving the DOC food purchases that have been in the media lately, and we'll try to respond to any questions you have about those issues on that day. And then, obviously, public testimony, and then another opportunity to probably come back and talk to the committee and hopefully respond to questions. As you have questions throughout this week plus of presentation, please don't hesitate to ask them at the time. It may be that we don't have the answer off the top of our heads, but we'll work to try to get those answers to you as quickly as we possibly can. So just briefly, agents...
Representative Hammond?
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max, I know that we have, Director Williams, I know that we have this book with the maintenance piece.
Yes.
I don't see that as a specific item, and it seems like a fairly large chunk of the work.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, we provided this to you in hopes that you could have a chance to look through it. We will, as we present specifically, and I'll reference it briefly today, but as we present specifically the General Services Division, in that section we'll also talk about that deferred maintenance package, and to the extent there are extended questions about that, if needs be, we'll allocate additional time in our schedule to address any of those questions.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll be able to show you some of this stuff firsthand a little bit, at least the ones that relate to the penitentiary on the visit on day three. So proceeding, slides three and four really talk about our agency purpose and scope, and we've covered that generally. Just as a reminder, our incarcerated population is about 13,400 individuals. The department also operates two community corrections offices in Linn and Douglas County, where we have the responsibility for almost 3,000 offenders who are under supervision in those counties, and then a large chunk of effort in administering the community corrections grant funding under the Community Corrections Act, sometimes referred to as Senate Bill 1145. Our mission is a public safety mission. We promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior, and we do that in a number of ways, but we've primarily consolidated in something we refer to as the Oregon Accountability Model, which is the department's business strategy. It's intervention strategies that are designed to try to change the inmate's behavior while they are in their period of incarceration. This does two things. It both increases the safety inside the institutions during that period of incarceration, but also acknowledges that 97% of this population return back to the community upon completing their sentence. And I've identified for you the six primary components of the Oregon Accountability Model. And we shared this with you before, and I won't take a lot of time today to walk through that, but we're happy to answer or respond to any questions you might have. On slide number eight, we've just given you a basic org chart that reflects not only the positions and how the department lays itself out, divided into five specific divisions with specific responsibilities, but also provided you the position and the FTE numbers associated with those positions. The point here that I'd like to make primarily is that if you look at our operations division, which is the one that operates the 13 and soon to be 14 prisons with the completion of the construction of Deer Ridge, you'll see that a majority of our operations, a majority of the employees in the department are actively engaged in the operations of those soon to be 14 prisons around the state. Virtually every other division in the department sort of is dwarfed in size by that focus. And that drives much of what you'll see as we refer to some of the budgeted issues as we move forward. Slide 9 just shows you again this clip of general fund expenditure statewide. You'll see how things are broken out, public safety being 12.2% of that. If you go to slide 10, you'll see the public safety budget, and we're 58% not including the community corrections component. If you add the pass-through money that goes to counties and community corrections, we obviously are larger than that as we administer that grant fund. As I pointed out to the committee before, almost all of our funding comes through the general fund. Only 6% of our funding is other fund funded, and a very small, less than 1% of the funds that we have come through any kind of federal grant funds. Next slide, slide 12, gives you again a similar kind of a picture, but then also demonstrates the point that I was making about where bodies are within the department. A substantial portion of all the FTE in the department is tied in the operations division, and that's an important distinction as we move through conversations about increases in FTE for the department. As you look at slide 13, and we talk about our breakdown of just our general fund, slide 12 is an all funds, total funds snapshot. But slide 13 shows you, again, sort of the breakdown by divisions of how we allocate our budget. And the two points I wanted to make here, again, is to note that $239 million for community corrections is really pass-through funding to the counties that moves through the Department of Corrections, who administers those grant funds under a formula. Mr. Chairman?
Can I ask a question about that, Max?
Mm-hmm.
When, prior to 1145, the money in the Department of Corrections, probation and parole was also part of the corrections budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, the way it worked prior to 1145, there were different kinds of counties. There were option counties, and then there were different options. You could be an option one, an option two, or an option three county. So prior to 1145, if the state Department of Corrections was running those counties like we now do in Linn and Douglas, those funds would go through, again, some sort of formula allocation, but then the Department of Corrections would keep those funds for those counties which they operated. If it was a county that had selected to be a self-operating county, then those funds would pass through the Department of Corrections to the county.
So to follow up, then, if we look back at, say, 1994 budgets for the Department of Corrections, if it were, I don't know, somewhere around $500 million, I guess, did that money include probation and parole?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exactly sure how they accounted for it in that 94-95 time frame in budget allocation. I'm confident we could go back and get that information and do a comparison if you're interested.
Yeah, I'm just interested in finding out if, you know, as we look back on those numbers, comparing apples to apples.
Sure, and I
could get that to the staff. And
yeah, we'd be happy to work with Mr. Wilson on trying to do that analysis. Again, as it was prior to the Community Corrections Act in 1996, 97, in that time frame, I'm not exactly sure how the accounting streams for those funds work, but I'm confident that the data is out there and can be compared.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Director Williams, this is just a general question. I'm not sure you can answer at the very moment, but
okay.
Just kind of messing with the numbers. One employee for every 2.7, 2.8 inmates, roughly 13.4 on inmates and 4,800 positions or 4,600 FTEs. Is there a comparable for that in other state prison systems that we could just get an idea about? Is that a number that you've are familiar with?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, I'm not exactly sure how that would compare to other states. We can certainly look at some of our resources and try to do that. My sense is from a staffing standpoint, as far as bodies to inmate ratios, we're not going to be substantially different from most states, but if there's data out there, we'd be happy to look at it. The challenge we've had is we've attempted to sort of do some of those state-by-state comparisons, is it's difficult sometimes to know whether you're comparing apples to apples or apples to oranges, but we're certainly happy to take a look at that and give you the best answer we can come up with. It is helpful, and I make a comment, but I can make it here to remember that unlike most state agencies, this is a 24/7, 365-day-a-year operation. So the organization never shuts down. It never sleeps. The doors never close. Whether it's a holiday or a weekend or the middle of a Sunday night, there is always staff and inmates moving through the department.
As a follow-up,
yes.
I just kind of crunch in the number because I've been involved a little bit with the site selection process on the mental health hospital and so on, and it's similarly 24/7, 365. Mm-hmm. They don't shut down, and the numbers, you know, that 3-to-1 type number, because they don't close the doors. So
right.
I'm just wondering if there's, I mean, it seems like it's fairly close, but I'm wondering in other systems, states.
We'll be happy to look and see what we can find, Representative, and
you.
Respond.
In response, just to maybe point you in the direction, as Max knows, I am a little bit fanatical about some of this data. I think there was a BJS report from the late 90s that compared states. I don't know if it would still be relevant.
Yeah, that's one of the places we'll look. There's also something called a corrections compendium that's produced that sometimes has some of this data that may be more recent and more helpful, but we'll be happy to review it.
Mr. Chair, just as a side or a note related to that, you need to be very careful because many states operate the parole and probation with state staff, while we rely on local staff except for two counties. So there are a number of factors that play into that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a follow-up along Representative Hanna's question, I think if we can't compare apples to apples there, maybe if we had a history of that ratio or a history of employees to inmates ratio in the state of Oregon, that might be a good comparison to see if it's changed or mm-hmm. what trends we've got from that standpoint that might be helpful too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, we'll be happy to try to slice it both ways and see if we can provide you some useful data. Just moving on then to the next two slides, and I won't spend a lot of time here, but we can come back if you have questions. This is that small amount, that 6% or so of other funds, not general fund, but other funds. And I've broken these two slides into sort of a sources, where do those other funds come from, and then an expenditures, where do those other funds get spent. There's a variety of conversations we could have here, and we're happy to provide the committee with some additional data. But by and large, if you look at the income of those other where those other sources come from, it's inmate welfare funds, it's charges associated with charges that we make to other state agencies or for others when we operate inmate work crews. There is some, the care of state wards is money that actually comes in through fines that are charged by the two counties where we operate community corrections. So there's a variety of sources where those funds come from. And then on the expenditure side, it's a similar situation. They're expended in various categories under each of those various divisions, but you can see the largest portion comes out of the COP funding and is then rededicated through to capital construction needs in COP under the recommended budget.
Yes, Representative Hanna.
Thank you. And I know we're going to go through a lot of this. I appreciate your indulgence, but I like to understand this.
Sure.
Director Williams, so on the revenue side of that, the $45 million and the fund sourcing for COP, that COP revenue is covering the entire capital construction piece. That would hold true, would it not?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, that would be the full amount of everything that the department is asking for in this governor's recommended budget with respect to COP funding.
So the $45 million is the entire ask on COP funding.
Yes.
But the difference between the capital construction piece on the expenditure side, does that relate to the maintenance?
Yes, yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I believe that it does. It's the deferred. The $34 million is specifically planning and design funding for the projected new facility, and the $24 million associated with the deferred maintenance package, and that's how you get to the $34 million. The difference in those other asks is a $6.5 million wireless package. There's about a $1 million amount tied to construction, debt service, and related costs, and there is new prison and community development position funding tied to that new construction as well.
Follow up. Feel free. Do we have that? I mean, will we have that breakdown, the difference between the – it's in here.
Yeah,
we're not there yet.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, that level of detail we weren't intending to do in this sort of overview, but we do have the data, and you will ultimately have it in your budget documents. And we can review it in more detail when we move through the capital construction portion of the budget.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and follow up.
Yes.
I'm just going to want to see that and I mentioned this earlier, I had a great deal of interest in the COP funding mm-hmm. piece. I'm going to want to understand the difference between the COP funding for capital construction as it relates to the new construction piece versus that which is in the maintenance package. And just a little spreadsheet maybe, you know, outlining those detail items that you just mentioned so that we can clearly see the difference between the two.
Yep, happy to provide it.
Thank you.
If we move to slide 16, it's just a quick view of the all funds increase in the budget. And I wanted to slow down just a minute, and Mr. Wilson laid much of the groundwork for what's on slide 17. But I really wanted to talk a little bit about this slide, because I think this slide 17 really gives you the framework of the primary cost drivers in the department's budget for this biennium. You can see that I've split the cost drivers essentially here in our general fund increase into two categories, community corrections and DOC operations. And I thought I'd take just a minute to talk about each one of those boxes a little bit, because I think it tells sort of the story. As Mr. Wilson pointed out, in our essential budget package, there are the roll-up costs associated with contracts, the labor agreements, the classification studies, merit increases, and then the full phase-in in this biennium, in the projected 07-09 biennium, will take on all of the burden associated with Warner Creek Correctional Facility. That phased in the last biennium up to full operating, so this will be the first full biennium that it's completely funded. Similarly, we had expansion projects at the female facility at Coffee Creek and also on the south coast at Shutter Creek. And all of those phased-in expansions and the Warner Creek and all the contract and labor agreement costs are associated in that 7%, that $72 million figure. The next box explains debt service roll-up. And there's a little trick to this one, and it took me a little while to figure it out, but I want you to understand it because I think it's important as we kind of move forward with this conversation. That $28 million figure is really two numbers, and it's broken down on the next page with the numbers, but I'll share them with you. $13 million is what the actual roll-up cost is for debt service this biennium. The $15 million was a decision made in the last legislative session to fund the finance costs of the debt service last time with additional debt service. So that got funded essentially through debt service last time, and that $15 million now in this biennium moves over to a general fund allocation. So it was money that was essentially obligated to debt service in the last biennium, but the legislature, in finalizing the budget, decided to not use $15 million of general fund to cover it. They just borrowed through the debt service function an additional $15 million to make up the difference. And that now moves over to a general fund obligation, and that explains then that $28 million increase.
Another round of COPs to pay for that, Kevin.
Well, there's always that option, Mr. Chair. But I think it is important to understand the breakdown between those two numbers. The next number is the – yes, and I'll pause. I think there's a question.
Thank you. So the $15 million piece that was borrowed was a – like a short-term note, so we're talking about retiring that $15 million with general fund in this budget. Did I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I think what happened was the obligation for the obligation sort of built in to the base of what we have to pay, that $133 million of debt service, that $15 million became sort of a long-term obligation. But in the last legislative session, the choice was made to, instead of pay for it with general fund, to borrow a little bit more money in the COPs that were going to be bought during that biennium to cover the payment for that for just the last biennium. So it's part of the larger debt service obligation. So we'll pay the $15 million this biennium, and we'll then carry that $15 million next biennium until over the 30-year period of time the debt's paid off.
Thank you.
If you go to the next box in that chart, that reflects inflation charges and assessments. And as Mr. Wilson said, our budget receives the standard 3.1% inflation. So in that $18 million number, $7 million of that is inflation, and about $11 million of that number are essentially new statewide assessments that the department has assessed, primarily through the Department of Administrative Services, but also assessments through the Secretary of State's office, the Treasury, and other places where we pay statewide assessments. So that's, again, another essential budget-level assessment that is included that the department really has no control over. And then that the last large box in that chart are the population growth figures. And what that really is made up of in this budget is the beginning operations of Deer Ridge, the DRCI facility in Madras. It's the operations and the startup costs. So $12 million of that number are the one-time startup costs associated with opening and starting up the Deer Ridge facility. It's a purchase of equipment and other things that are associated with the startup of that facility. And as a side note, I just need to let you know that as part of the governor's reductions to our proposed budget package that came through the Department of Administrative Services, there was a 15% reduction in our startup costs at Deer Ridge. So prior to even our budget getting approved by the governor, there was a 15% cut in those startup costs, which accounted for about $2 million in reduction. So that was initially projected to be about a $14 million cost and then was funded at about $12 million. And then finally, as Mr. Wilson pointed out, down at the bottom, our policy packages that are not related to community corrections come in at about $13 million, or just slightly more than 1% of our overall increase. If you move on to the next side of the chart on community corrections, and I think this is going to answer the question that Representative Hanna had asked previously about the difference between inflation and the caseload roll-up in community corrections. As we walk through these, I'll explain it. The roll-up of existing caseload, or that $10 million figure at the top there, is essentially the difference between where we thought the caseload was going to be when the budget was created in April of 2005 and what actually happened in the experience. And as Ms. Porter, I'm sure, will point out when she makes her presentation, the community corrections caseload grew faster than had been forecasted. So what this budget roll-up includes is it includes essentially all that was in addition to the forecasted increase, and that's the $10 million figure you see there. Then there's 3.1% base inflation applied to that package, and that's the $5.6 million. What you see then in that next gray box is the projected caseload, given what we have with the current existing forecast projections over the next biennium, and that's that 0.8%, or about $8.5 million. And then the last block on that community corrections component is the actual cost study for community corrections, which we've discussed a little bit thus far. And in Ms. Ginger Martin's presentation later next week, you'll hear a lot of conversation about how that actual cost study was put together. But this is essentially to try to bring community corrections up to what the actual costs are actually are being incurred by the counties, and to address that into the future biennium. So that really, I think, in sort of this one page, explains primarily the major budget drivers about the difference between the legislatively approved budget in 05-07 and what's in the governor's recommended budget for 07-09. And if you'll turn...
Max, can I ask
yes,
you a question about that?
Yes, certainly.
So looking at the caseload of $8.5 million, what I hear you saying is that was the anticipated projection based on the forecast, and then two levels up is what the actual will be once those are combined?
No, Mr. Chair, I probably didn't do a very good job of explaining it. It's a little bit of a complicated discussion, but I think what you have in the – and Mr. Wilson's going to draw a chart for us here. He's going to help me.
And I can't remember what box.
Roll-up of existing caseload.
Roll-up existing caseload. That's actually the caseload, the cost of the additional caseload to get to 24 months. So in 05-07, if this is caseload growth and this is what it was, that we funded this portion in 05-07 because it was growing at that point. What we need to sort of pick up, the increase, is the amount or the inverse of that, which is this amount here, because to pick up the full 24 month of the 05-07 caseload growth is that, how much is it,
$10.364.
Right, so that represents to get the full 24 month of the 05-07 growth, and then the next amount is this amount, the other figure, the 8. Whatever figure. And so when we start building the 09-11 to biennialize what we did here in 07-09, this will be increased in building that budget just to correspond with that. Does that help?
Well, Mr. Chair, the point is that community corrections caseload comes on. It comes on. It ramps up over time. So people start coming on at the beginning of the biennium, and they continue to come on the community caseload, the community corrections caseload, right up to the end of the biennium. But if they're on that caseload and they become part of the forecast because they're on that caseload, those numbers typically carry over into the next full biennium, and you have to account for them because now they're on, and they're on at the full 24-month value as opposed to the person who came on in the last 2 days of the biennium. And that's what that's really capturing. And it's compounded by the fact that the caseload grew faster than the forecast had anticipated. And so those two things working together. The darker gray box, the third one down, is projecting out, again, as Mr. Wilson pointed out, what we believe, based on current forecast, the caseload to be in the 07-09 projected budget.
And so Ms. Porter will discuss the projections not only with DOC behind bars, but also in community corrections.
Absolutely, right. And those are all forecast-based numbers, and then actual experience that attempts to catch up. I'm sorry.
I feel like I'm interrupting all the time, but I want to understand this. So it goes back to the question that I asked then. out of that $50 million increase, then the inflation piece of it is simply the 5.6. So we could pretty easily say 11% of it's the inflationary piece, the rest of it's caseload. 11% of the $50 million is the 5.678.
Yes.
So the inflation is 11% of the total increase, the rest of it's caseload.
Mr. Chair, I think 11% is the inflation, about 38 to 39% is caseload growth, and then about half of it, the bottom box, is the policy package, which is
the 25 million,
right.
24.5. So okay, I added that piece in.
Right, but okay. That's not caseload, that's, for lack of a better term, rebasing the amount we pay counties for community corrections.
And Mr. Chair, this is the point that I also want to make sure, because I'm using just the increased numbers here. That inflation rate isn't based on just the numbers you see here, but it's an inflation rate based on the entire community corrections caseload number, which in the 2005-2007 budget was about $190 million and is now projected to be the 239 number. So there's those bigger boxes. What I was trying to show here with this chart was simply just the increases and the drivers as to how you get to a 25% increase in the DOC budget.
Thank you. I got it.
Okay.
I think
great.
I got the numbers.
To just give you the next slide on slide 18 walks you through some of the actual numbers associated with that. So if you have questions about that, please let me know. I won't take the time right now to go through those. It's much the same thing. It's just given to you then with the numbers. Similarly, if you'll turn to slide 19, you'll see the same numbers for community corrections laid out in more of a chart form. And then the other funds drivers as well on page 20, which, again, we'll go into some more detail as we talk a little bit more about these. There are a handful of fairly interesting sort of accounting things as to how money is lodged there that for the small amount of money it is in the budget and the little minute of time I have today, I won't take it to talk to you about, but we can walk through those and provide you some additional detail. And I think what I'd like to do now, if I could, Mr. Chair, because I know you'd like me to talk a little bit both about some, if you turn to slide 23, I'm going to talk to you just briefly about key budget drivers with respect to population. And that conversation might take us through a point where I would stop and then come back maybe on Monday and talk to you about our KPMs, our key performance measures, and ensure that we give Ms. Porter her time today. So I'll move through this next few slides and then pause until Monday. Key budget driver with respect to population, and this is kind of reinforcing some of what we've talked about, which is this labor and workforce cost, our inflation and operating expenses, the Deer Ridge startup, full operational cost of Warner Creek, our expansions at Coffee Creek and Shutter Creek, the debt service, and the changing inmate demographic. I wanted to just make a couple of points on these issues, and we've talked about DOC being a 24/7 operation. I often think about the agency with somewhere in the neighborhood of right now 42 to 4,300 employees and then growing through Coffee Creek, but we also have then the 13,000-plus offenders in the system and then these 33,000 individuals that are under community supervision. And while they're not direct employees, obviously, of the agency, they're people that we have responsibility for. And the size of it, I think, is sometimes something that needs to be thought of. I did a quick check today just for my own purposes. If you counted just our capacity inside the prisons and our staff together, and you called us a city for purposes of kind of comparison in Oregon, would be the 26th largest city in the state, wedged in between Pendleton and Forest Grove. If you were to include the 33,000 people under supervision and included that in sort of our overall pick and called us a city, would be the ninth largest city in the state, wedged between Corvallis and Springfield. So when you think about the nature of the operation and the individuals that we're dealing with, and the span of control issues, I think it's a sort of a good reminder about the size, and it helps at least for me to understand sort of why an organization that is as large as it is can have the kind of roll-up costs that are primarily associated with even something like a small percentage inflation increase having to be so significant.
If I can just add to that, I think what you're getting at, too, is that there are more and more people just in society generally who have some cross with the criminal justice system. So at some point in your life, you'll probably be in an elevator with somebody who's been in one of your institutions. And I think the question is, would you rather have that person go through a treatment program or not in that elevator with you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I run into people when they find out what I do almost every single day who, in some way or another, who have had either a family member or themselves incarcerated, and sometimes in very unusual places. So I think that you make a good point. As the system is larger, it touches a larger number of Oregonians, but it also has a much larger impact. And when we start talking about things like roll-up costs, for example, as we get bigger, those costs get bigger, and they become a bigger part of the general fund. Another point that I just want to make sure people understand is, unlike a jail system, DOC really doesn't have any matrixing authority. We don't have the ability to, when we get full, to just start letting people out the other side of the system. So we're required to ultimately house for the length of their sentence the individuals who were sent to us. And that creates then these issues of us needing to come forward, anticipating forecasts, and talk about where are we going to put people who are coming into the system and how best to do that, how best to manage that population increase. The other point I wanted to make here was the changing inmate demographics. We are older. The inmate population, by and large, is getting older as a percentage of the population. They're getting more sick. They have a higher degree of mental health issues. And those things are definitely having an impact on our operational costs. And as Mr. Wilson pointed out, the cost per day per inmate is going to continue to increase as we address those same sorts of cost drivers that challenge the private sector and operating a private sector business, whether it's labor costs, whether it's employee costs associated with health care, or whether it's the $150 million plus HMO, essentially, that's being operated currently inside the Oregon prison system and the drivers associated with that. And to just give you some sense of that, the folks over the age of 61 over the last 5 years has grown by 40% within the prison system. So those inmates who are older than 61, we've had a 40% growth in that population, and a 30% growth in the population of the people who are between the ages of 46 and 61. So as that population, again, ages and we have a larger number of them, the medical issues associated with that. Similarly, I'd tell you that our mental health population, those who are severe or who have the highest mental health need, in the last 5 years has more than doubled. And you'll see these issues addressed to some degree in our policy packages as we want to talk through those. I'm not going to spend any time really talking about it. I've included slides regarding the population growth and the history. You've seen these before, and Ms. Porter will comment on them. I'd simply point out that on slide 28, one of the things about the timing of construction, because I know that's an issue that the committee is concerned about, and it's one we're pleased not to be here asking you to authorize the construction of a new prison, full bore costs, this biennium. And the point that I simply want to make here is that the ability to delay the construction of a prison not only saves us on debt service, but it saves us obviously on those startup and operational costs. As we look both short-term and long-term. The downside of too much of a delay is that it increases the costs. It raises issues about rental beds and the ability of the system to be able to sustain itself if those populations actually come in. And ultimately, a system that's trying to manage solely a population issue by crowding facilities then can't dedicate itself to its focus on program delivery. And so it has negative impacts, obviously, on being able to administer programs. When you've crowded people into all your program spaces and you don't have a place to put on an A&D treatment class, or you've had to basically not spend the money on A&D to deal with the additional staffing costs associated with watching people in a crowded environment, it simply means that you're at that point really focused focusing just on the housing side and not much on the reformation and program side. The last point I'll make as I prepare to turn it over to Ms. Porter is this point on slide 29 that I think it took me a while to actually even internalize after becoming the director, that not all beds are equal in the system. Meaning that a prison bed is not a prison bed is not a prison bed. The complexity of the population that we're addressing and their variety of needs and the variety of needs we have in managing that population doesn't allow you simply to just figure out how many total prison beds we have and look at the forecast. The type of bed to match the inmate need, and the aging population is a good example. We're having to change some of our design plans to deal with this aging population because you can't have people who are not capable, given their age or given their health condition, to climb up to a second bunk or a top bunk if they're, you know, potentially wheelchair bound or having to walk with a walker. You've got to provide them an appropriate accommodation. And as we address those issues, and I've listed other ones out. Obviously, mental health beds, the custody level of the inmate, whether they're a minimum level one type custody or a close supervision inmate, those beds are different. Program beds are different, whether or not they're engaged in an intensive alcohol and drug treatment program or whether they're simply on a work crew in a general population dormitory. The kind of bed and the way those services are provided matter. Intensive management, our maximum security units, are very expensive and very limited beds, but you have to right-size those beds for an increasing population and anticipate how many of those you'd need. Similarly with mental health beds, special needs, administrative segregation, and the like. So I provide that to you just as a cautionary understanding that when we're looking at total bed counts and total inmate numbers, that there's not always an exact match. And when we build a new institution, we have to address those issues.
Actually, we've got a couple of questions here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned rental beds, and I understand that there are pros and cons and various considerations, but at some point in the presentation, are you going to have information for us that tells us statewide what the capacity is and the utilization rate of all of the beds available in municipal and county jails plus state facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, that's always because of county choices within county jails that we don't control, somewhat of a moving target. But we can at least give you the information that we currently have. We have a fairly regular communication with counties. We do rent beds from some counties even now to accommodate the population, and typically we're aware of availability. So that's certainly something we can talk about and provide you information on.
Thank you.
And perhaps we can enlist the help of the Association of Counties in that update as well.
They've always been helpful in the past.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Barker.
Mr. Robinson, when you talk about the aging population, I would assume there's a lot of people who are not going to get out or would be in their 80s or something. Is there a program set to train them in elder care? I mean, it's people, so that people when they're 60 can be taken care as they move through that system. So you have an in-house training program that's going to have to take care of an aging population.
Chair Shields and Representative Barker, we have a variety of those programs, including training inmates to be inmate orderlies and to assist other inmates who have disability issues. And that does occur currently in the system. We also operate, as many of you know, in our infirmary area in the penitentiary. We have a hospice program for inmates who are dying of terminal illnesses. And inmates are trained by the hospice people to be hospice volunteers inside the institution. So we're doing a number of those issues to try to address that issue and to provide as much of that sort of end-of-life care as possible using trained inmates to do it. It creates, obviously, as you might imagine, a variety of issues that we continually have to monitor and ensure from a security standpoint that everything is appropriate. But we do some of that work.
Is there any plans or any thought about follow-up? I mean, in the future, like, to have actually like a geriatric facility someplace where you might not need as many guards and so on, or corrections officers and so on, to control that, and yet where people can have a fairly decent
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, we are doing some planning, and in fact, I will leave with you, as we end this, a form that I had developed that's not in your book that I wanted to share with you, which sort of shows the ramp-up of how we're going to bring on the units at Deer Ridge, and it's something we can talk again about on Monday as I complete my presentation. But we're also planning using some of this data for the next design. One of the nice things about not having to rush out and build immediately and have the opportunity to do some of this design, I refer to that sort of gap between what the forecast told us we were going to be 2 years ago to where we are now. I'm referring to that personally as the opportunity gap, because I think it gives us an opportunity to revisit some of these conversations. And one of the things when you're having to just build a bed to house a population stream is you don't have much time to rethink the kind of beds that you're building. In June of 2006, I changed around some of the divisions inside the department and created an Office of Population Management that reports directly to the director's office, because in the middle of our strategic plan and our initiatives that were a lot around this population management issue, it became apparent that we needed a greater policy coordination internally in the department to plan exactly as you've mentioned, not only for that population but for a variety of other populations, as we've come to the conclusion that a bed is not a bed is not a bed. And so we're addressing those issues, and we'll spend some more time talking about that.
If I could, we'll probably need to make sure we have enough time for Sue. You think it'll take about a half hour for her to get through her presentation?
Is that about right, Ms. Porter? Good. Then we'll go ahead and wrap up then right
okay.
now.
Thanks, Max. And then also, if you could try to get to us any type of breakdown that you do have on the kind of beds that you'll need, even if it's just minimum, medium, maximum. Is that something you can get us?
We can certainly provide that. And I think, in fact, in your book, you'll see there is a population report letter that I'm obligated to prepare and send to the governor and to DAS. That's actually in the appendix that you currently have in your book. That will answer, I think, some of those general questions, and we can maybe try to find a more graphic way to reflect that.
Great.
All right, so I'll finish up on Monday.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to discuss the prison population process and forecast, Ms. Porter, would you please come
forward? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter. And I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis.
I'm sorry, you need to hold that and speak up.
Can't
record it. Thank you.
Okay, how's that? Okay. My name's Suzanne Porter. I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis, Department of Administrative Services. And Dave Beck is with me today, the acting state economist. And we're here today to talk about the corrections population, a forecasting process, and I brought along our latest forecast is from October of 2006. I'm not going to go over it in any detail. I just brought it to show you what the product looks like. And we're working on another one right now, and the due date for that is April 1st, but we hope to have it maybe the third week of March.
Excuse me for a second, Ms. Porter. I understand you guys might need to have a conversation, but could you take that in the hall for now?
Kate's just bothering me.
You
know.
Go ahead, Ms. Porter.
So what I wanted to do today is just talk about the process and then really briefly how the model works, and then our track record, and then a little bit about the growth driver. So I apologize if I try not to get into too much detail. So hopefully it won't get too boring.
No, we need the detail. This is an important process we have to understand, so take your time.
Well, to overview the process, we forecast pursuant to a statute and an an executive order that tells us how often and the populations and so on. So everything we do is to comply with one of those. rules. And we have a 10-year forecast horizon. We're supposed to update semi-annually, and the due dates are October 1st and April 1st. And we have an advisory committee that helps us. And on the back page of the handout, this one, the last page, has the current makeup of that advisory committee. And they meet with us twice every forecast cycle, and they're an integral part of the process. And any success we have, is we couldn't have done it without them. Failures, I'll take responsibility for. The populations that we forecast are prison, felony probation, parole and post-prison supervision, and local control. Those are the four that we have to do. And in reality, I think these are, I mean, all these populations affect one another. And so we set our model up to try and mimic the way that reality is. So the number of people on probation can have an effect on ultimately on another people on in prison, who will affect the number of people eventually on post-prison supervision. The data that we work with come from the Department of Corrections, from their computer system. It's case by case, you know, individual records. Each record represents an intake and a release for a, you know, we have a file for each one of those populations. And so it's detailed person by person, and then each person, you know, like a transaction, when they came in, when they went out. And then we also have a snapshot file for each one of those populations. So as of January 1st, we'll have a snapshot of who is in prison and when they're scheduled to get out. We get a lot of data elements from corrections, but the most important ones, of course, are the date of intake, data release, or the projected data release. The reason for intake, is it Measure 11, repeat property, was it a drug crime, and so on. The reason for release, that's important in the community corrections groups. Did they, were they released because they successfully completed, or were they revoked? County of origin is another important one. We don't forecast by county, but if we see a change in the data, that's one of the ways we'll look at it to see, did it come from a particular county, and then it's easier to find out what happened. And then finally, the age of the offender. The other data sources we use are Oregon Uniform Crime Reports. We get arrests by age, and we get that once a year, and it's usually about a year after the fact. So we just got 2005 data about a month ago. We get felony guideline sentencing reports from Criminal Justice Commission. We use those to identify repeat property offenders. We haven't got a, we have to manually find those. And statewide statistics from the Oregon Judicial Branch, we use those to get an idea of what kind of intakes we can expect. And that, you know, the cases move, most cases move fairly quickly through the system, so we can look at OGIN data for, we'll have January, it comes in pretty fast, January, and that can give us an idea of what's going to come into the prison system and probation maybe up till June. After that, you know, we haven't got it, that's not going to help us. And then finally we have population by age, historical and forecast, and that comes from a variety of sources. What we're trying to do is we forecast current practice and current policy, so we're not trying to anticipate any change in the law, any change in the way counties do business. We can get a pretty good look at what's going on right now, and then we're going to forecast that current practice against population growth by age group into the 10-year future. So what our forecasts are saying is, if we keep doing things the way we do them right now, given the demographic growth, this is what we would have in the future. We use what we call a flow model to do the forecast. It tries to mimic offenders as they move through the system. And the heart of it is something called survival probability, which is something demographers use. And the way we use it is, for example, you have 100 people come into probation in a given month, and we'll use this. The survival probability is going to tell us of that 100, how many of them will be left the next month. January, we had 100 come in. How many will still be there February, March, April, and so on? So that gives us the releases. We do that, you know, month by month in all these populations, and that gives us the releases. We have intakes, we take out releases, and that gives us the monthly population. We use a number of software packages, but the actual model is in Excel. It's a bunch of spreadsheets that are interconnected. So we have developed the model by ourselves over the years. It's not an off-the-shelf black box product that we use. And that gives us the flexibility to, you know, if there's a new law, we can add that. If, you know, we can take, you know, simplify it if we need to. So it gives us the flexibility to adapt along with the laws that are on the books.
For Senator Nelson.
One of the questions I've been asking is if, say, we add on 139 state highway patrol, will this forecasting model project how many prisoners you might come out of that? Is that something that can be done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that is something that we would probably, for something like that, we would discuss with our advisory committee to try and get a handle on, you know, what kind of crimes would we expect to be detected from that kind of increase in enforcement, and then work from there as to whether it's going to affect the prison system, probation, or so on. But it's something that we would, you know, wouldn't build explicitly into the model. We'd use it to say, well, there's going to be more growth in this certain area.
Just follow up, I mean, my sense is that if we do something with the state police, it's going to affect you at some point down the line, and how do we build those costs into it?
Well noted.
I got that point across.
I'm with you. I got it.
Can you draw me a picture of that? I'm losing this.
Okay. The intake side of it, we have to forecast intakes, and 51% of the intakes to these different correctional populations are actually moving from one part of the system to the other. For example, they're in prison, and now they're going to post-prison supervision. Or they were on probation and they got revoked and went to local control. So they're not new to the system. They're moving around. The other 49% are what we call new, and that means they weren't on supervision at the time that they came into wherever they are. That doesn't mean they haven't been in the system before, just that they weren't being actively supervised at the time. So those are the two populations we have to forecast, and we have a different technique.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
So that's interesting to me. The 51% of intakes are moving within the system. Do you have any idea of the people who are coming into a DOC institution, what percentage have been there before?
Mr. Chair, not off the top of my head. And I go on, you know, because I'm looking at were they on supervision or not. But I could find that out.
Is that something you could look into? Please?
Yeah.
And get it to the professional staff. Thank you.
And if they were on probation and went to prison, are you interested in that, or you just want to know people that were in prison?
I suppose if you could break it down, that would be fine. But the main thing I'm interested in is of the people who are actually going to prison, who's been there before.
Okay. Okay. And I have on page 8 of my testimony, there's this little schematic that shows kind of how our model works. So if we, at the top, there's arrest and felony conviction. These are the new people, haven't been in the system before. They could get one of three dispositions. They're going to get prison, probation, or local control. If they get probation, they can either successfully complete that. They might get a technical revocation to local control. When they're done with local control, they would go out on post-prison supervision. They could complete that. Or they could do another crime that might wind them up in prison. Along with new people going into prison, once they're done with prison, they go out to parole and post-prison supervision. Again, they can successfully complete that or commit another crime and just be in a feedback to prison back and forth. So that is how our models are set up to work.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
Ms. Porter, just so I'm clear, is each one of these boxes, and when we talk about, going back to the previous page, about intakes, it's when I move into one of those boxes, am I technically an intake?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yeah. Because we are going to forecast the parole and post-prison caseload, so you're going to be an intake to that.
In that box. So we'll
yeah.
Follow up, if I may.
Sure.
So when we talk about the 49% are new intakes, that is the box at the top, correct?
That would be, system? You could be mainly probation in prison. Those are the new ones. Almost everyone that goes into probation is new.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question about that? Because I seem to recall having clients at Better People, the organization I started, who would, you know, they might be on parole for something, they catch another charge, it's not enough to send them back to prison, but they might be given probation. So they could be on parole and probation at the same time. Is that taken into account here somehow?
Yeah, that's true. And I don't know exactly, the data are cleaned up before I get them, but they can't be serving on, even though they have an open sentence in both places, they're only on the actively, they're only on one caseload. Okay, for those new intakes, which are mostly prison and probation, how we forecast those. And it's different. Okay, for the first year of the forecast, we have some other things we can look at. We can look at recent intake history, what's been going on lately. And we can look at arrests, although they're a bit dated. We can look at court cases filed. That's going to help us know what's coming in the next 6 months. And then we can present all this stuff to our advisory committee, talk it over with them, get some feel for, you know, what's going on in the system, and come up with a growth rate for the next year. Now, beyond that, call that first year is going to be our current policy. Beyond that, years 2 through 10, we're going to take those same, characteristics and forecast them forward based on population growth by age. So we're looking at growth 18 to 24 year olds, different. But beyond the first year, we don't have any way to know, are there going to be more drug arrests next year? We can get an inkling of it from our advisory committee, but we don't have any systematic way to say, yeah, for sure, there's going to be more assault arrests next year. So we try and gather that for the first year, and we're going to call that current policy and forecast it forward that way. The other intakes, the people that are moving from one place to another, they're easier for us to deal with. And with those, we're looking at the probability of failing supervision. So, for example, we have 100 people, again, those 100 people that go on probation in January. We can look at how many of those people are going to fail in February, March, April, and so on. And then once we get that gross number of failures, we can look at typically how many of those are going to go to prison, how many of them are going to go to local control. And there's a there's a set pattern to how that failure happens. It's different for post-prison supervision. It's different from probation. And it's different for the type of crime the person did. But it's a fairly stable pattern. So that's what we use for that other 49%. The people that go into post...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned it's a fairly stable pattern for you to be able to forecast the failures and so forth. Do you see, do you pick up as blips and changes in the pattern when there's a some sort of a new program introduced in prison that has to do with either training for post-prison work or reintegration into the community? Do you see patterns change as we provide additional services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, the patterns do change over time, and but I have never gotten to why, and that'd be a research project. When we do a forecast, we look at historical pattern, and then we look at what's different right now. So we could say, yeah, it's a little bit lower right now, but we don't get into why. But it could be done.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question too, Ms. Porter? You say you know it's pretty predictable how the percentage of people that will fail. What are those percentages?
Mr. Chair, I look at the pattern over time, and just going from memory, I think it's about in the 30%, and it's a little bit different for parole than probation, but it's right around 30%, and I'll go back and look, and if I'm off, I will get back to you and correct myself, but just going from memory, it's around that much. To the releases side, for prison, we separate prison intakes into Measure 11, repeat property, and everybody else because they have different lengths of stay. In prison, there's length of stay is determinate. So for people that are in prison as the beginning of the forecast, we can release them according to their projected release date. And we can, adjust it a little for the rewarding and rescinding of earned time credit. We have an adjustment for the alternative incarceration program. Then we have inmates that are not there yet, future intakes. And for those, we use typical length of stay for inmates that have come in recently. We usually take the last 2 years. We're trying to get as many inmates as we can that have already been released because that takes care of that earned time credit, rewarding, rescinding issue. We don't want to get too far back in history because we might pick up obsolete patterns. So we're trying to balance between having a good amount of people that have been released and also having the newest information. Other releases from probation, local control, and post-prison, the length of supervision there is indeterminate. So a person is sentenced to, say, 5 years post-prison supervision, but they may not spend 5 years. They may be a model offender and get placed on unsupervised probation, or they may go the other way and commit another crime and go to prison. In either case, they didn't spend 5 years on post-prison supervision, and the same is true for probation. So for that, we're looking at, again, we have to go back in history, but we look at the probability of, again, of those 100 offenders that go on probation, how many of them will still be there in February, March, April, so on. So that's how we do those indeterminate. It's the probability of you go on that status in a month, what's the probability you're still going to be there the next month and the next month after that? And those, again, those tend to be, we divide all those up by the type of crime. In other words, violent crime, property crime, and behavioral crime. And there's a pretty distinct pattern to how those people serve also. So we have intakes, we released them, now we have a population, and how have we done? On page 13, we have our prison population forecasts, most of them going back to April 97. And it shows how old the forecast is in months, and then the average error over all that time. And then in the final column is the average error for the 6 to 30-month window, and that's because when we do a forecast, that will be used for the final budget preparation for a biennium. That critical period is the forecast is going to be from 6 to 30 months old. In other words, we'll give you a forecast in April. It starts as of last January when the biennium starts. It's going to be 6 months old, and when the biennium ends, it'll be 30 months old. So it'd be nice if we could be accurate at least for that time period. So the forecasts that are in full, then I missed one, April 97. But those odd number April forecasts those are the ones that were used for the final budget preparation, and it shows the error over there. So it looks like we've had three that were spot on, and two where we were 2% off, and one of them we were 2% low and one 2% high. So all in all, we don't like being 2% off, but all in all, the errors have been on both sides, up and down. The next page is community corrections, which is a little more, this is more difficult to forecast. Again, part of it is because the forecast is older. By the time the biennium starts now, it's 9 months old. There's a data lag. So for the forecasts we're preparing right now, the community supervision population starts with October 1, 2006. So by the time the biennium starts, we're already going to be 9 months old. And then on top of that, we have the issues of indeterminate sentencing is an issue for us. Again, the odd number of years are there. The first two look pretty good to me now when I compare it to the April 2005 one where we were 5% low. And on the next page, it kind of gives you a look at what happened there. This is a community corrections population since October 2001. And it's mostly driven by the probation population. That's what really drives the up and down in the total community corrections caseload. And starting in 2003... if you recall, at the end of that 0103 biennium, the courts deferred some cases. All the, I think it was Class C, non-person felony cases were deferred, and you can see that caused the caseload to drop.
Ms. Porter, just a moment. Do you think you'll need about 5 more minutes? Is that just so that I can tell the committee members? Can you guys stick around for another five?
I can't. I've got
okay. Well, if you need to go to another appointment,
okay.
We're with you.
Okay. And since the recovery from that, we've had pretty consistent growth. Now, if you look at the beginning of 2006, the slope on that growth, it was pretty steep. And all that has been, that growth, almost all of it has been from drug, people with drug convictions coming into the probation caseload. And when we look at arrest data for 2004 and 2005, the number of people arrested for drug crimes went up. Just going from memory, I think it was about 15% increase in 2004. And it went down a little bit in 2005, but not much. So I kind of think that's what fueled that increase. And we had some discussion with our advisory committee on that. One of the theories is that with the work that was done with meth and making the labs, you know, making it harder to have a lab, so there's fewer labs now, but still there's drug enforcement out there. So now we're getting more offenders, I mean a greater number of offenders, and they're going to, vast majority are going to qualify for felony probation. So we think that's what's driving that. I don't have any arrest data at all after 2005, but we're going to be looking at cases filed. They really haven't come down much since then. So that's what drove that, you know, the reason why our forecast was so low is just that huge growth in drug arrests going onto the probation caseload. And then finally, I have historical growth drivers. This is something we did back in June for the, it was a judiciary committee. And we're just looking at historically, and this is from the April 2006 an excerpt, what caused the growth in the prison population. And at the bottom of both graphs, there's kind of a flat, dark area. That is the prison population without any of these policy changes. And then you add on to it, you have Measure 11 and repeat property. Those are the really the growth drivers for the prison population. And these are the impacts. So this is, we're just trying to isolate the effect of the law, not, you know, just everybody that's convicted under the law. So that gives an idea of what's causing the growth. Now, if you can, you can see the growth in Measure 11 has slowed way down. I mean, it grew real rapidly, and now it's starting to taper off, and that's because the number, in the beginning, Measure 11, people went into prison, they didn't come out. Now, over time, people are coming out. So I think we usually have 20 more intakes than releases every month. Back in the 90s, we had, you know, 60 intakes, nobody got out. So the growth is slowing, and eventually it'll stop growing. And so we're in a position now, I think, where the growth in Measure 11 is slowing, repeat property is slowing, and so it's this other population that can cause the population to either stop growing, like we had in, I think it was 2005? It's these other populations, that the growth in Measure 11 is slowed enough that things that are going on in other populations can affect it. And even when we get to the point where we stop growing, there's going to be times when we do grow and we do fall based on what's going on in enforcement out there. So, you know, before, when everything was just growing and growing, things that were going on in enforcement were mass, was not that big a deal because the population was growing. Now when growth tapers off, it gets more critical, that, you know, there will be times, I mean, the population isn't going to be X. I mean, there'll be times when it's going to be X plus something and X minus something.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, I've looked back at some of the DOJ or DOC fact sheets over the years, and it was just amazing the precision that you were able to hit the mark with. And then just recently we're seeing that the growth, it hasn't been as high as you projected 6 or 12 months ago. I heard you touch on why the projection was off a little bit on those in community corrections, but what do you think was driving the slowing in the prison population?
Mr. Chair, with prison, it's a combination. When we look at all people going into the felony system and the disposition rate, you could look at it like we had just the rate was a little bit tipped toward probation and not, wait a minute, to prison, the way we forecast it. Just slightly too many people to prison and not enough to probation. So that's where the probation problem came and part of the prison problem. The other part, though, is that the length of stay for not Measure 11, not repeat property, but everybody else, the length of stay there went down. So when I look at back in 2003, the length of stay, I'm going from memory, was typically it was about 6 months longer than now. So that played a role in it too. And why we one of the theories we have is that the Blakely decision might have something to do with it, but we don't have any systematic way of say, you know, that's exactly what caused it. But it's both things, length of stay and number of people.
Well, we should probably let people run up to their next appointments. Were you finished?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if we have other questions, I'm sure Ms. Porter would be delighted to come back. She's just right across the street.
Can't wait.
Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.